from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Travis DiNicola. Today I'll get to chat with the guys who make up the group Time for Three.
I'll get a preview of A Christmas Carol and Love Letters at the IRT.
And I'll find out what's going on at Christopher West Presents. Plus, there's our arts calendar we call What'll We Do?
All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. The groundbreaking, category-shattering trio Time for Three transcends traditional classification, with elements of classical, country western, gypsy, and jazz idioms forming a blend all its own. The members, Zach DePue on violin, Nick Kendall, violin, and Renan Meyer, double bass, carry a passion for improvisation, composing, and arranging, all prime elements of the ensemble's playing. Travis DiNicola had the three guys in our studio to find out more.
Gentlemen, welcome to Art of the Matter. It's great to have the three of you in the studio today.
This is Zach DePue.
This is Renan Meyer.
This is Nick Kendall.
You know what I want to do before we talk about Time for Three is I just want to give a little bit of background on each of you individually, because each of you have your own careers in music. Zach, let's start with you.
Graduated Curtis Institute. I grew up in Bowling Green, Ohio, born and raised, and grew up in a family of four violin-playing brothers, and went to school in Cleveland Institute of Music for a year, studied with the concertmaster of the Cleveland Orchestra, Bill Prussell, and studied at Curtis, where I met these guys. Out of Curtis, I was concertmaster of the Curtis Orchestra, and, you know, you play a lot of repertoire while you're a student there, and different various area orchestras or whatever, soloing and playing in. And then joined the Philadelphia Orchestra for 5 years, and continued to play with Time for Three, these two other guys that you're going to hear from, Renan and Nick.
Hi.
And joined the Indianapolis Symphony in 2007. I've been serving as concertmaster here and living here. Indianapolis is my home. It's my third year living. And
it's been great having you here.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, and you're what, like the youngest concertmaster ever or something like that?
I wouldn't say ever, but I'm younger-ish.
It was here at the ISO.
Ish.
Youngish.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's been absolutely fantastic having you here the past 3 years, and
thanks, man.
And what you bring to the city. So yeah, thrilled to have you on the radio. It's nice to be able to chat with you.
Right on, man. It's great to be here.
Renan.
Renan Meyer, Curtis Institute of Music. Just as the sound is cool, if you're a musician, you need to be a football star.
I can
to
put
say
some
that.
Like vibrato on there afterwards, really? When I remix this.
I've always wanted to do. I get Donovan McNabb, Syracuse.
You need some background music for that.
No. We'll work on that. I went to the Curtis Institute of Music, which is where I met these guys. And after that, it was really great because it was an opportunity for me to play all different styles of music, arrange and compose, perform all in one ensemble. And it was kind of what I trained for all my life, sort of not realizing it, because I started playing jazz when I was 15 and improvising, and it sort of was my catalyst for all different genres of music. So I went to Manhattan School of Music for classical, but I played a lot of jazz.
And you're a bass player.
Yeah, I'm a double bassist. Mm-hmm. I should have done that. Renan Meyer, Curtis Institute of Music, double bass. and when I was in New York City, I started playing world music and all these other styles. And when I got with Nick and Zach, it was an opportunity just to play all different genres of music. After Curtis, besides Time for Three, which has been a huge part of my life, teaching privately, starting camps, double bass camps, as well as classical jam band camp, basically an opportunity for classical musicians to learn how to improvise and compose and arrange and perform as well. also another band that I recently started, which is a totally different instrumentation. I've kind of been focused on just variety in life, so it's I've really been extremely fortunate with the career that I'm having and continue to having, and Time for Three is definitely, you know, leading the way.
Cool. Nick, now, you've actually been hanging out here in Indianapolis off and on since 98, right?
1998. I was here for the Indianapolis Violin Competition, International Violin Competition, and I was here for a couple weeks and got to know the city. So, of course, coming back now with this wonderful collaboration with the ISO, with Time for Three as Artist in Residence, it's really special. But, yeah, so it's been, I have a great relationship with the city. It's familiar territory. But I, obviously, like Renan and Zach said, we all met at Curtis. So I was there for a couple years, and I came from Washington, D.C., where I pretty much grew up. And I was studying classical music all my life. But Washington, D.C. kind of was a great gateway for me for other styles of music, hip-hop, R&B, and actually Washington, D.C. still has one of the only lasting bluegrass stations on real FM radio, not XM satellite. But
excellent.
And it still exists, but I grew up with listening to that. So all sorts of kind of styles while playing classical. Went to Curtis, was predominantly there to, you know, for a solo career. Graduated Curtis, went to have a career with a professional management agency, Young Concert Artists, that promoted me as a soloist across the country, which I did a lot of. And that was also when Time for Three, we were all sort of coming together at that time. Big part of my life. And actually, on some of my big debut recitals, like in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. Kennedy Center, New York City, and in Boston, I asked these guys if they'd come do an encore set. And so that was kind of like one of the ways that I was able in my life to bring the two worlds together, that of my solo career and that of this rogue group, Time for Three, back then. But then, of course, it turned into something which is pretty much the predominant thing in my life. But like both of the guys in the group, you know, I'm doing side projects as well. I live in New York City now, so I play once in a while with this great band called the Village Underground Band. It's in the West Village. Totally awesome, amazing musicians, and they've created this 20-minute set around just an eclectic variety of violin music, and I play electric violin and acoustic violin in that.
Cool.
So that's one of the things I'm doing, and
I heard a story that the way that you guys sort of got started, it almost sounds like a Frankenstein movie. It was a dark and stormy night, there was lightning in the sky, power was knocked out everywhere, and sort of your bodies were reanimated through lightning and something and started playing your music at a concert. Is that even close to it? Or
something to that effect.
I remember it in the exact same way.
Really? Yeah. Dr. Frankenstein, you know, standing over you on the slab, yeah?
Yeah.
Seriously, how did you guys get started? It was, Philadelphia.
In Philly, and predominantly the group had been playing gigs, really, around town while we were still in school, just corporate events. The school caught wind, Curtis caught wind that we had this group, and it was being utilized as just a, you know, sort of what the students do in the off hours, but these guys seemed to do it really well and portray it in a really fun and cool way. So we did a lot of events, some fundraisers and what have you, and I'd spent a full season in Philly Orchestra. At the summer of 2003, Renan had been subbing, and Time for Three hadn't been something that we were all taking seriously, quote unquote. And
yeah.
I don't know if we take it seriously now either. It's just that we just are busier, but it's, you know, we try not to. It's been an organic process, I guess, is my point. But so basically, at the Philadelphia Orchestra, the Mann Music Center, which is a theater that holds like 4,500 people, outdoor theater. Scheduled to do their last concert there, a Philadelphia Orchestra, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. There was a bad storm. The power transponder had been hit by lightning.
Okay.
And so the building had no power except for emergency lighting at the front of the stage and one emergency microphone. And 8 o'clock was the start time of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. It came and went, became 8:10. And they were like, what should we do? We don't want to lose the audience.
Right.
You know, the fear of having to give back the money for the tickets, I think, a management side. And so they were like, what should we do? And Renan and I were there, and people were like, well, these guys play in that group, and maybe they should go out there and entertain our audience for a little while and see what happens. So we went out. We agreed to go out there.
Yeah.
And went out there and took the mic, placed it near the bass. I sat in a chair, and we proceeded to just play the tunes. The three of us played the gigs. Nick wasn't there, though. Nick was at Marlboro Music Festival, and I think probably getting text messages from people in the audience saying, dude, your boys are like...
like, where are you, man?
...getting in front of a packed hall.
Amazing messages I had.
Yeah. So, meanwhile, Renata and I went out there and just played all this stuff that we had been playing at those gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And we got done with, like 20 minutes. And we came off, and they're like, can you do more? We don't have power. So we were like, you gotta be kidding me. So we went back out there, and... it was like, the next piece on this evening's program is... I mean, we were literally just ended up giving a little program.
Yeah.
I mean, I think like another 15 minutes. And by that point, they had fulfilled the time allotment that made it legal for them not to have to return tickets. Power wasn't on. And even if we had started Beethoven's Ninth at that point, we'd be going until 11. So it was like, all right, we're cool. And that was sort of like a big turning point in that... you had an audience that was there in place for a very serious classical piece of music.
Yeah.
And it was packed. And they left very happy hearing a lot of this very folk fiddle Americana program. I mean, people were really enthusiastic. It was almost as if the feeling was that they had forgotten they were there to hear Beethoven 9.
Mm-hmm.
And that they had really enjoyed hearing this stuff. And that, wow, maybe we should take this seriously. People.
That had to be a pretty cool moment. Yeah, you know, certainly, the style of what you play, the sound, and the selections is different than what I'm about to compare you to. But the first time that I heard of you guys, and then first time I heard you guys play, what it really reminded me of is when I was back in college. I was 18 and went to a concert. Kronos String Quartet had come to school, and I didn't know what they were. And go in and sit down, and they start playing Purple Haze. And that was just like all of a sudden this amazing moment where it's like, wow, you can play this type of music on these instruments, and it really sort of changed everything for me as far as what I started appreciating. I think in terms of specific music is not limited to specific instruments, I guess, is sort of what I'm getting at. And it, I mean, you guys bring, certainly a very cool factor to what you're doing, I mean, you look cool up there playing the instruments, you're playing cool music, you're making it seem, really accessible. I mean, is that, consciously sort of a part of what you're doing to...
Well, I spend a lot of time playing my bass in front of the mirror.
So you do practice the cool factor.
Yeah, it's important.
No, I'm just kidding.
It really is just a lot of fun to use your imagination and to think creatively, to pretend like you're, 5 years old, but, maybe a little more sophisticated than that with what you can bring to the table. There's actually a really cool guy who... we were at dinner with that I actually had not been sitting near, but Nick and Zach had, and they told me this story after the fact that really resonated. They were sitting next to this this man who played violin in the orchestra. His profession is actually law, and he had played with us. We soloed with this particular orchestra, and he said, the thing I really like about you guys is when you get up there, it's like, we're all kids in a sandbox and we're about to just play with our toys, And you bring us back to that moment. And I think that's one thing that I felt when Time for Three got together for the very first time. It was just so much fun to jam with these guys, with us guys together. We weren't doing it for any other reason except to explore the possibilities of what we can do through our instruments and through music. And it wasn't like, we said, hey, let's get together and let's explore the possibilities of what we can do through our instruments and through music. It was more so like, let's just get together and jam.
Yeah.
And we just had a lot of fun hanging out together, partying together, all the same age pretty much, year apart. And just hanging with our instruments. And it's really never changed as far as when we get up on stage.
Yeah.
That's what it's about. That's what we aim for, to be loose, to be ourselves, to let the personality shine, to let the style shine, to evoke the emotions. When we're doing the business, that's when sometimes we get a little serious. But when we're up on stage, it's about, really just letting it all hang out there.
So what's the difference, Nick, Zach, between a fiddling and playing a violin?
I think the only difference is the approach, how you play your instrument, because really is set up the same exact way. I mean, perhaps like an old-time fiddler, well, their instrument may not be as refined as one of a concert violin, but it's the same principle. You have four strings tuned in fifths, starting from E, A, D, and G, and with a bow. It has a bridge, and it has the same setup. So it's really just the attitude and the approach to the music. And I think now what we're finding is where, you know, Time for Three is kind of organically come to where we are now musically, but you find so many, in America at least, in the top conservatories and at Curtis, you're finding young students who are embracing, you know, their American heritage almost, especially coming from, even from Europe. You have and in Asia, you have jazz-influenced musicians now who are incorporating this other side into their voice and how they're going to, you know, graduate from those institutions into the world of music. So it's very exciting times, and we're just kind of one group that may have pioneered, you know, the idea at first, and now it's kind of like old hand. Not old hand yet. It's still a pretty new concept.
Hey, speaking of new, tell me about the new CD you guys have coming out.
We have a new album coming out. We signed our first record deal last year. It's been a wonderful process. We have actually our dear friend from Curtis. He's a conducting... He graduated as a conductor and is also a singer-songwriter and a fabulous arranger. Is the producer of this album.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided to call it Three Fervent Travelers because of kind of the symbolism of our literal travels and the many different genres that we pull from. And the album is an eclectic mix of different things. Two covers, one of which is Hide and Seek by Imogen Heap, which we're very proud about, and we actually are featuring as a single now for download for 99¢ on iTunes if you want to go. Time for Three, I'll spell that. And our album, Three Fervent Travelers, will be available in January, late January.
Cool. Hey, Zach, let me ask you, what does it mean to have Time for Three be in residence with the ISO?
Wow. Well, you know, knowing these guys outside of the institution itself and knowing what they're capable of in communities as we've traveled, and then, you know, as I've come to know Indianapolis and, you know, these guys, like Renan shared that story about, you know, the orchestral musician saying, you guys have a way of making this fun for most everybody. Whether it's, you know, in our case, we've come here now twice solo with the orchestra. Once was for a pop show, which is lighter and definitely fun, but we just came and played this concerto that was written for us by Jennifer Higdon, and certainly in a classical setting. But there still was a vibe of fun. Energy. There was a great energy in the room overall, and I think knowing that before these guys ever got here, how exciting that is to have them here is definitely a wonderful thing. Their capability of cross-pollinating genres, demystifying the instruments. Like you said, you saw Kronos play Purple Haze. I mean, these guys are very capable of that. And also just being personable guys. A lot of times I think the classical musician has been maybe pigeonholed a little bit to be a certain type of person, and they're really not. I mean, everybody up there on stage is a lot of cool people, a lot of very interesting people, and you know, part of the responsibility is for us as musicians in the orchestra is to have a community effect, and so these guys are a great conduit for the institution to be represented outside of the performance hall, be able to get into any situation, whether it's an urban school or a suburban school or a bar, but able to take these instruments in front of an audience that necessarily wouldn't even consider going to a classical concert, but it opens the door by showing these instruments doing a lot of different things. So that door, once gets open, it's a huge impact. It's not to say that Purple Haze represents what classical music is or where it's going. It's just that this is music, and it's music for expression's sake. And having these guys here is a wonderful, wonderful tool, and they're great at what they do.
Travis DiNicola with the trio Time for Three, Zach Depew, Nick Kendall, and Renan Meyer. Zach Depew is also the concertmaster of the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. For more information on Time for Three, visit tf3.com. That's tf3.com. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
If it's the holidays, it must be time for the IRT's A Christmas Carol. Sharon Gamble invited IRT's Managing Director Stephen Stolen in to talk about the popular Tom Haas adaptation, as well as the theater's unholiday production of Love Letters.
Well, the weather outside is frightful these days, but you have something warm and cozy about to open to the public. It's been playing to school kids for a while, but how many years is this lovely Christmas Carol tradition now?
Well, the IRT's a snowy stage, iconic Christmas Carol. It's in its 14th iteration right now. It's 14th year in this iteration,
mm-hmm.
although we touch it up a bit every year, and that's a interesting game. We could talk about that. But it premiered back in 1980 when Tom Haas did the first adaptation. So it hung around for a while, but now it's on its 14th consecutive season.
Now, I know that's before your time with IRT, but certainly the stories have been handed down. What were his goals in making the adaptation?
Well, Tom was a big Dickens enthusiast. He loved Dickens, and he was by no means a purist, but he was very devoted to it, to the literature-based idea. And so, as the story goes, and has been handed down through the ages at the Indiana Repertory Theater
since the 80s,
there was a production about that time of the Royal Shakespeare Company's Nicholas Nickleby, and it was 8 hours long.
Right, right.
And what it did, it captured the narration through actors. And so actors would turn to the audience and they would say, "And now Sharon Gamble said,"
mm-hmm.
and then Sharon
and
would
then
speak,
they go into the action.
And then the narration was done by actors. At that time, principally a principal narrator. But what has evolved over time in the production of the IRT is that all of the actors, save Scrooge, participate in that narration. And so that kind of creating a smooth kind of transition to addressing the audience and then being back in the action and having that all occur, you know, right in front of the audience is part of the magic of that. That Nicholas Nickleby was also on a Spartan stage. There was no scenery.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, in a way, became the inspiration for the production now, which has no scenery,
mm-hmm.
which we look at the original back wall of the 82-year-old Indiana Theater Building, but covered in snow. And so it seems like a production. It seems like it's got scenery. And, of course, we have a set designer and a stage design to it. But the idea was to get out of the way of the language in many ways and have it be driven by props and costumes and, most of all, by the beauty of the language delivered by, you know, talented actors.
And what's especially cool about this, it seems to me, while it's attractive to people of all ages, I imagine that for a lot of I know you have thousands of school kids who get to see this, and it's probably a bit of a revelation, even in this day and age, that actors are turning and doing that director address to the audience. It makes it more conversational.
I think so, and I think probably especially to them, Sharon, to student audiences, and you're right, it'll play to about 18,000 kids. It'll play more student matinees than it will public performances.
Wow.
It's a remarkable thing. I think it humanizes it in a way that they're not merely characters, but they're actually real people telling you about what's going to happen next with Mr. Scrooge,
mm-hmm.
or that he's going to now dance with Belle, or whatever the situation is. And so I think it does have a very positive kind of way of making Dickens have an immediate accessibility with kids. It sounds kind of lofty to put it that way, but it makes it easier, I think, in some cases. And I think it makes it easier for all the theater goers. You know, the theater going, the carol going audience, many of those people, that's their only visit to the IRT this season, just like the Yuletide is the only visit for symphony goers and Nutcracker is the only visitor, the only time dance goers go. And that's perfectly fine. So I think it gives people the story in a way that they want to receive it. It makes it work. It's a great idea.
It makes the formal language of the era more accessible in a way, too.
Yeah, and the beauty of the language then. So it's there's a kind of naturalness to it that maybe just simply off the page delivered by a character maybe is not quite so natural.
Mm-hmm. What do you? How do you decide to change it up each year, and where do those ideas come from?
Yeah, well, they come from the Artistic Brain Trust, Janet Allen, and Priscilla Lindsay, who's directing the show for the 11th consecutive season with her usual beauty and style and grace. We bring back a designer almost every year to come and look at the way the costumes, do the costumes still feel the same way? Do the music, for instance, last year, we reorchestrated all of the music. And so they were all played with original, with real instruments, with authentic instruments, not authentic to the period, but real string sound instead of in some places synthesized or electronic.
Right.
And it had a tremendous aesthetic impact to those of us who care deeply about music. To the audience that doesn't notice that as much, they probably think, well, that's great, but they may not have noticed.
They may not articulate it.
Yeah, or maybe in some cases we don't even really want you to notice too much, unless you want to, because there are some people that want to come and want it to be just like the last time they saw
it. It's tradition, darn it.
Don't mess with my Handel's Messiah too much, or don't mess with my Nutcracker too much, or my Christmas Carol. And so they want those things that are so important, and it's so it's kind of a delicate little dance we do about how much to change. But I think in this year's production, we've done that really well.
Yeah.
I don't want to reveal that.
I was going to say.
Well, you know, when Tom created Christmas Carol, some of the characters were not in Christmas Carol. You know, there were chimney sweeps, and there was a midwife, and there were children in the mines, and there were all kinds of things. Dick Wilkins, who's become a very important character over the last, you know, two-plus decades, was not an original character to the show.
That's so cool that there's room for growth within the tradition.
Well, and I think it's great that there's an openness to that. I think part of Priscilla's greatness as a director is because, as a working artist, we don't replicate. Artists don't replicate. They do it again, and it seems like it's the same thing, but it's really never quite the same thing. And so, from a production standpoint, I think we're charged by doing that sometimes.
Sure.
It's worked out very well for us.
It's an evolutionary craft.
And fun. It's fun for the company. It's fun to go looking for. Where's that? Oh, I know they're going to say that line sometime. Where's that line?
Do you have a favorite moment from this year's production?
You know, I love all the Bob Cratchit family things. I've always loved those things. We have a new Bob Cratchit this year, so that's one of the things that's new. Ben Tebbe, who I think audiences love every time he's on stage, is going to be Bob Cratchit this year. So that's a wonderful new thing. I love the moment that Christmas Present arrives. The ghost Christmas Present. And this year, David Allen Anderson returns to do that with that big belly laugh. And he says, "Ho, ho, ho, you've never seen the likes of me before." It's a wonderful thing. I'm harking back, as you asked me, over the years, many years ago, there was a time when that character emerged from a lift underneath, and it was a man dressed in drag. And when he said, "You've never seen the likes of me before," it made an impact on the audience that was like unforgettable.
Yeah,
and
I can imagine.
But, you know, so I think folks who are really familiar with it, of course, have their favorite things, and everybody waits for Tiny Tim to say what he has to say.
Of course.
Chuck Goad is back as Scrooge, also for the 11th time. And, you know, it says something about somebody who wants to keep doing that and freshen it up. And he's got a completely new sidekick with a new Bob Cratchit this year. So I think it's going to be a really fun time for the audience. And it's faster.
Hmm.
That's all I'm going to say.
Okay.
Faster.
Ooh.
It's got some giddy-up.
I'm
some additional giddy-up to
I'm
it.
I'm intrigued.
There you go.
You talked about Priscilla being a working actor, and in fact, as we turn the page towards the new year, she's going to be back on stage instead of behind the scenes.
Yeah, she's going to, as soon as she gets Christmas Carol on its feet in the rehearsal room and moving toward the stage, she will start rehearsing herself for our production of Love Letters that will open in the middle of December, December 15th. Patrick Clear will return to the IRT in that two-person show on the upper stage. And if folks like, you know, Priscilla, who is, you know, one of the great artists in this community and certainly the leading lady at the IRT, I think they're really going to love her on the upper stage, where they're going to see, they're going to look, you know, right into her beady little eyes as we do a really fully produced Love Letters. Sometimes it's not so produced.
For listeners who might not have experienced Love Letters.
A.H. Gurney wrote Love Letters, and it really is the text, the book itself, is really a sequence of letters with two characters who, in a kind of gross generalization, start as pen pals and then end up in some of the predictable ways and some surprising ways. Often this play has been seen by theater goers in big theaters and Broadway tours. Hume Cronin and Jessica Tandy traveled the country for probably as long as they wanted to, playing the parts in this show, and quite literally reading the letters and throwing the pages on the floor.
It looks like a staged reading.
Yeah, and it's got its own charm. This will be fully produced, so it's really a play in the way we're doing it. Janet Allen is going to direct it, and with that cast, I can guarantee that people will not be reading letters and throwing them on the floor. There may be a little bit of that, but I think it's really meant to be a really intimate experience, and so I think audiences are going to really like that production on the upper stage with two really great, great actors. Patrick was with us earlier in the fall. He was in The Heavens Are Hung in Black. He was Jefferson Davis and Secretary of State Seward, not at the same time. And so he comes back and will be a wonderful partner for Priscilla Lindsay in that production on the upper stage.
One thing that's important to note is that if that sounds, love letters, well, but there's such a range of emotions.
Well, it's
from the very warm to the explosive.
Yeah, and very funny.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, I think the great thing about really producing it, instead of reading the letters, there's an opportunity for it to be much deeper than just, you know, they're not going to be just reading letters to the audience. We're going to really have a relationship that's going to have its edges and its corners. And, I'm confident and sure it will do exactly what theater is supposed to do. It's going to allow us to see ourselves in those characters. Mm-hmm. It's going to allow us to have heard those conversations between our parents or our grandparents or our neighbors
or
perhaps even ourselves, whether you were in love with someone or not. And I think that the whole correspondence thing is the hook. But it's a very humanistic story. It's had all kinds of wonderful portrayals, Hume Cronin and Jessica Tandy being, you know, certainly one of them. There's a great story about, you know, can you imagine James Earl Jones and Elizabeth Taylor doing this? Well, they did it one night as a benefit for Elizabeth Taylor's AIDS charity and raised, you know, over $1 million in one night. But can you imagine the two of them doing it more than once? They would have killed each other. And probably everybody else within earshot. So
it's also interesting in this day and age, because you probably do this when you're mentoring students. I always tell students, if you really want to stand out to a prospective employer or an organization that you want to be affiliated with, write a handwritten note.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody relies on email. And have you ever heard of anybody bundling up a bunch of emails they've printed out, putting them, tying them in a pink ribbon and putting them away in a box of memories? No.
Yeah, that's a great reminder. And it's a great reminder to all of us about how we feel when we get a beautiful note.
Yeah.
When somebody writes you a letter, I mean, there's still a wonder in that. Even with my 11-year-old child, getting a letter,
it's a big deal.
It's still a really great thing. I guess it's old-fashioned, but it's probably never out of fashion. So there's a wonder in that that's still pretty great, and that wonder impetus, I hope, it's going to make for a show that I think audiences are going to really, really like. So.
What's your thought in opening in mid-December?
Well, you know, we've been, a couple of years ago, we made a strategic decision to try to run on two stages through the holidays. We felt like after the 25th of December, after that holiday, that there was some real estate out there and some opportunity out there. And so 2 years ago, we did Tuesdays with Maury, mm-hmm. believing that if we went with a title that had that kind of appeal and resonance, yeah. that would do well. And it did very, very, very well. Last year, we did This Wonderful Life. And it sounds like that would do really, really well. Well, you know, nobody caught any breaks last December. We're done. Hmm. Everybody's done whining about everything that was challenging about last year, at least
we've moved on to what's challenging about this year.
You and I have.
That's right.
We've got enough to do right now. I think there's a debate. There would be a debate in the industry as to whether you should have two holiday shows at the same time.
Yeah.
Do they nibble at each other's audiences? I don't know. Moving to the middle of December was a strategic decision because we felt like we could we didn't have to fight with the sort of beginning of the holiday. Our subscribers would come to the early part of the run, we believe, and then we would have some time for that show to get some momentum and people in the community and perhaps, you know, like folks that are listening that might not be regular theater package buyers or season ticket holders, that this would have an appeal to them at a time when you could just go to the theater and have a good time. And that worked pretty well for us last year, not as well as Tuesdays with Maury.
Sure.
But I hate for us to be dark in that time, you know, where their families are home.
Well, and a lot of people have time off, and yeah, kids are home from
so,
college or whatever.
You know, I don't think any, you know, you do this too. You nobody has the secret. I think we've got a good show. We'll have a beautiful production. The story is terrific. We'll give everybody an opportunity. We give ourselves and everybody else an opportunity to really enjoy it, and we'll see. But I think part of it is landing there, Sharon, is to try and avoid the early clutter. It's a clutter meaning in all the good ways. There's just a lot going on.
Yeah,
and to try
absolutely.
And fight through the sort of force field that is the holiday season right after Thanksgiving is a sort of a tough road sometimes. So we're going to try it this way, and we'll see how we do.
Sharon Gamble with the Indiana Repertory Theater's Managing Director, Stephen Stolen. You can see A Christmas Carol through December 27th. A.R. Gurney's Love Letters runs December 15th through January 17th on IRT's Upper Stage. Get information about Ladies' Night Out and other special events at irtlive.com.
Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
Who is that over there in the corner? Hey, who are you?
It's an escaped turkey.
Wait a minute. What are you doing back here? Well, according to my Turkey to English dictionary, it means he ate too much on Thanksgiving and he needs some exercise, so he came to hear our calendar segment that we call
What do we do? You have a Turkey to English dictionary. Wow. Okay. Well, you know what? However he got here, we have lots of stuff to do. There's so many things going on.
Burn calories.
Full holiday
swing
in the season of things.
That's true.
A great show I try to make every year, the Toys Art Show. This is an annual exhibit by Primary Colors. This is actually their seventh installment of their invitational holiday art exhibit.
It's a lot of toys.
Isn't it? It's a lot of toys. Artists make artwork that's somehow connected to, based on the theme of toys. Always a fun show to see what people come up with. This is taking place at the Art Box Gallery, which is connected to the Stutz Building over off of West 10th Street. Opens Friday, December 4th from 5 to 11. Definitely going to go there.
Very good. Say, if you spent the day after Thanksgiving, the biggest shopping day of the year, at shopping malls, and maybe you're one of those people who got up early at 4 o'clock to get the door-busting deals, here is something you might want to do for a complete change of pace from the crowded malls and the canned music. You can experience the holidays circa 1865 at the Morris Butler House, where you can get guided tours of the three-story house, which is, of course, decorated in Civil War-era fashion for Christmas. And there are holiday afternoon teas and all sorts of storytelling and events for the whole family. And you can Google Morris Butler House and find out more about those holiday activities.
Cool. Hey, another opening that's coming up next Friday. It is First Friday, in fact, after all, next Friday night at the Harrison Center for the Arts, their annual holiday show. This year is titled, it's always a color, you know, Sharon.
Yes.
This year it's black and white and red all over. You remember the show, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's there's obviously a literary theme, and so
I get it.
There you go. And so that is taking place at the Harrison Center, and the opening is from 6 to 10 on Friday, December 4th, down there at 16th and Delaware.
Very good. Hey, a reminder that Indie Folk Series is doing its traditional Saturday after Thanksgiving open mic night this Saturday, November 28th. All artists, performing artists are welcome. You need to be at UUI, which is at 615 West 43rd Street, by 6 o'clock Saturday evening to sign up to make sure you get a spot in the performance schedule. Performances run from 7 to 9, and Open Mic Night always celebrates and raises money for a good cause. In this case, it's Something to Crow About, which brings transformative art experiences as well as much-needed art supplies to kids in low-income schools. So you can Google Indie Folk Series and find out more about Open Mic Night this Saturday, November 28th.
You know, if you time it right, I think you could see at least four different nutcrackers between now and the holidays. Gregory Hancock's Nutcracker is coming up next weekend, which will definitely be a non-traditional take on it. But also want to mention that the Indiana Ballet Company and its affiliated Russian Ballet Academy of Indiana is going to be doing public presentations on December 11th and also on the 12th. And you can check out Indiana Ballet Company for more information about that. And then the weekend after that, the Indianapolis School of Ballet is presenting the Nutcracker, and they will be at the Scottish Rite Cathedral doing that on Friday the 18th through Sunday the 20th. So lots of different options of ways to see the Nutcracker.
Dance your way through all those Nutcrackers,
can't you?
Yeah, indeed. Hey, at the Athenaeum, you can do some traditional holiday activities on Sunday, December 6th from 1 to 5. There's a dance workshop for kids age 6 to 12, gingerbread housemaking, games, crafts, a puppet show by Adzook's Puppets, nostalgic Christmas tree. Thank you. the turkey's fault. Christmas tree candle lighting. Yes, the old German way with real candles. And the arrival of St. Nicholas and a Christkindle market. All of that's going on at the Athenaeum on Sunday, December 6th.
Wow. Do you remember that time when there were only three channels on TV and all those holiday specials were something we all just sort of gathered around for? We were as excited about as, you know, the turkey coming out of the oven? Well,
yes. Why are you reminding us of this?
Because,
I'm wondering.
Well, if you're looking for an alternative way to celebrate the holidays, then a very Phoenix Xmas 4, Our Stockings Are Stuffed. It kind of harkens back to those times, a simpler time, or at least a more interesting time as far as what they've pulled together at the Phoenix. They've received over 60 submissions from different playwrights across the country to put together their holiday show. Some great sketches, mainly humorous, a few poignant ones, and some that remind us of those old-fashioned celebrations, and some that do not at all. But it's the way that the Phoenix celebrates Christmas, and it's a very Phoenix Xmas that is going on now through December 20th.
I seem to be in a late 19th century mode for some reason on today's calendar, but I want to let you all know that Freetown Village is doing an 1870 Christmas, and that production opens on Friday, December 11th. And you can find out how Christmas was celebrated in the 1870s. Lots of changes since then.
Very cool. Hey, last thing I have is over at the Harrison Home, they've got an exhibit of political cartoons that is opening on Sunday. And to kick that off, cartoonist Gary Varvel from The Star is going to be there and unveil the new exhibit and show off some of his original work as well. Sounds like a really neat collection
of
work.
I heard about that. That sounds awesome, yeah. And my last item for today, your days are dwindling. You have until November 30th to see at the Stutz Arts Gallery the Site Insight Artists and Places of Inspiration exhibition. Don't make me say that a second time.
I won't.
So, Mr. Turkey, did we satisfy your desire to find some events to go out to burn calories and get some turkey culture? My dictionary says that's an enthusiastic yes.
Pluck that one out of your hat.
Okay,
we'll be back next week for more of
What Will We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
In just 3 short months, Christopher West Presents has become a significant part of the Indianapolis gallery scene. Travis DiNicola spoke with Christopher West and artist Jeff Giza about his show opening in December.
How are things going at Christopher West Presents? You've got 2 shows under your belt. You got the 3rd one coming up?
We do. Things have been going great. It's been really well received by the neighborhood. You know, we've had a photographer in there for the last show, and before that was its installation artist, and having that street presence, it's great interacting with the neighborhood that way.
You know, it's really exciting that you're there, and especially right now with, I mean, there are other galleries in town that are struggling a lot, but because of the relationship you have with the Dean Johnson Gallery and the ability to be in there and bring some stuff that maybe you couldn't even bring into a regular gallery.
Absolutely. It's kind of because of these tough economic conditions that we were able to be creative and set up this scenario in which we can kind of present some really cool things in some prime space.
Some very cool contemporary art in prime space. Tell me about why you chose Jeff for your 3rd show.
Well, Jeff, I think when you come and see the work, you'll see that it's, you know, impeccably done. But it's got definite twists and hints and even not so much hints, direct humor to it. And that's one of the fun things, I think, about contemporary art, that it can be so many different types of things. It doesn't always have to be a serious, somber moment. You can throw in some whimsy and some comedy into it. Coupled with the fact that the paintings and the installation he's doing are so well done. It's a nice combination.
So it's a combination of paintings and installation. Jeff, we're recording this actually right before Thanksgiving, so my question to you is, over the holidays, you get together with your relatives, and you get the question, what are you doing with your art? How do you describe what you're doing at Christopher West Presents?
Well, not sure how I'd describe it to my family. I'm still trying to figure that one out. But well, for the sake of this, I'm interested in comedy, as Chris said, as a communicative device and communication in a general sense, language, those sorts of things. I like to refer to myself as a visual comedian rather than an artist.
Give us an example of that. Is it, I mean, through visual puns, through the use of text? I mean, how does that transpire in your work?
Well, precisely, visual and textual puns. I try to have the work, you know, spin off in a lot of different ways. It's about complexity as much as it is anything else, and my embrace of confusion, of my own confusion over the world and all of its many things.
Now, you grew up here in Indianapolis.
Right.
And just got back. You've been living in New York City for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
And stuff. And back here. So what's your take on what Chris is doing with Christopher West Presents?
Yeah, certainly. And, you know, all my experience there. But it's great to see Christopher's new space. You know, when I got back, it seemed like all my favorite places, you know, Flux and all those sorts of places were closing down. But I did kind of immediately realize that, well, this might be a very exciting time for the city to see how it kind of reemerges.
Let me ask both of you this question. Chris, the past two shows that you've had, the first one was an installation piece with sort of these found objects, a lot of sort of like glass and plastic and things. The artist...
Danielle Reedy,
and then the second piece, the photographs that mm-hmm. That show's just closing now
by Craig Doty, correct?
With both of those shows, I found it enormously helpful to me to have a combination of you and or the artist explain as an audience member what I should be looking for. And I know that the next show, in fact, you have with Emily Knurk, her work is very conceptual.
Yes, it's coming up in January.
Very conceptual as well. I'm going to ask both of you this. Jeff, Chris, what is it that you would want to make sure that people walk into the gallery, know about your work ahead of time so they can appreciate it better?
Well, just my kind of embrace of duality and plurality and... You know, understanding that there's often more to be seen than meets the eye. look for clues, look further.
Sounds
or
like a
don't.
Puzzle.
Yeah, yeah. They often are. Do kind of function on that level, and I like having that experience as a viewer. And so I try to kind of recreate it of having it be less of a passive experience, so that. You know, you do have to, in fact, activate your mind while looking at the work, and really that kind of is the work. What happens in your mind as you're piecing things together and the associations you make.
But Jeff's show, and I think this applies to Craig's show, which is coming down right now. The photographs, they can kind of be appreciated on multiple levels, and that's one of the things I like about the work I'm presenting. You can walk in and have kind of a purely aesthetic experience and hopefully come away with a smile or think that's interesting, but then there's also lots of further depth, so the more you want to read into it, you can keep going with it as well. Jeff's titles are very important to the work. I think you'll see that too when you're reading the titles. The title is actually part of the piece.
Right. So sometimes the piece is an excuse to have a title, honestly.
Well, interestingly, the first kind of working title for Jeff's show was Untitled, and we were talking about that titled as opposed to Untitled.
Right.
You kind of putting that emphasis on and making people make that second look.
Travis DiNicola with curator Christopher West and artist Jeff Giza. Giza's show at Christopher West Presents opens on Thursday, December 3rd. For more information, visit ChristopherWestPresents.com. ChristopherWestPresents.com. Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4. I'll get a preview of the Off the Walls show at the Indiana State Museum.
Matt Sosi joins us for a look at the Indianapolis Children's Choir.
And I'll find out about the men's chorus Madrigal Dinners, Masters in This Hall. And, of course, we'll have our calendar events we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.